the reason we think these are kind of interesting is because we have some particle physics models that we like, which say these things maybe could form, maybe could exist. And also because they're kind of crazy, right? The signature from these things, it turns out, is completely crazy. And if we saw this, it's not really anything else it could be. So why not go and look for it? This is work I've been doing with David Curtin, who's also at Toronto. So, you know, we're particle physicists. The reason we care about astrophysics and cosmology is to, you know, disprove or prove our particle physics theories. So the sort of models we're interested in are those which have mirror sectors. So I'll explain what I mean by mirror sectors. So we have a specific model in mind that we like, namely the mirror twin Higgs model. But I don't expect you to care about that. In general, mirror stars could form from a wider variety of models. So I'll talk about mirror stars more generally, and then I'll talk about how we might be able to see them. So what is a mirror sector? Well, we all know what this, you know, the standard model particles. A mirror sector is just some kind of other sector which has copies of all the standard model particles, approximate copies anyway. The idea being that these, you know, all interact among themselves in the same way that the standard model particles do, but the two sectors don't really talk to one another apart from via a couple of sort of weak portal interactions. And this idea has kind of been around for a while, just because, you know, Z2 symmetry relate one sector to another. It's kind of an elegant-ish idea, but there are some well-motivated models that have appeared more recently, which, you know, relate to naturalness and things like that. So this one particular model that we're interested in, the mirror twin Higgs model, versions of this model predict something rather like this. In this model, the most minimal thing you can imagine is that this is just a copy of the standard model, but it turns out that to evade collider constraints, on this model, you have to raise the masses of all of these things by a factor around 3 to get around your collider constraints. These models also have a cosmological issue, is that because they have other light degrees of freedom, they can contribute to this delta n effective observable and predict a much too large value of this. There's various ways of getting around this, which usually involve messing up this nice sort of mirror symmetry that we have. But the story that we like is this asymmetric reheating story. The idea is you add some new particle which decays preferentially into the standard model as opposed to the mirror sector, and thereby dilutes the contribution to delta n effective from the mirror sector. And again, you can suppress this just by taking this ratio to be, you know, I think a factor of 1 over 5 is enough to get around the current sort of constraints on delta n effective. Which is nice. We like this because it means that we can sort of retain this approximate Z2 symmetry between this sector and actually make some predictions. So we can ask fun questions like, you know, what is the nuclear physics of the mirror sector? You can go and predict things like the mirror proton mass and mirror deuterium binding energy, all in terms of this sort of one parameter, the ratio. This is the ratio of the Higgs-Bev, so I should say the mirror Higgs-Bev, which is the same as the ratio of the masses of one sector to another sector. And you can make a bunch of predictions. You can go and do some cosmology. There's lots of interesting stuff at cosmology to say about this specific model, which I'd refer you to this paper if you want to know more. But you can, for instance, predict the mass fraction of mirror helium, which in the standard model was about 25%. But in the mirror sector, this mass fraction, you can just by inputting this sort of ratio of the masses, it comes out as about 75%. So the mirror sector, if it exists, has a lot more helium than the standard model sector does.
I'm asking this, what is the ratio of those Higgs bags?
So you have to take it to be about a factor of 3 to get around collider constraints, or around a factor of 5 to get around this delta n effective problem.
Minimum of that?
Yes, right. So so we take it as 5 to be the sort of the minimum. It could be viable, consistent with other constraints.
So the coupling constants are all the same in the mirror.
That's the minimal assumption. Right.
If that were allowed to be 1, would the cosmology be identical to the standard cosmology because you just have the same amount of mirror stuff?
I guess so. Yeah. And I should point out as well that the mirror sector can't be all of dark matter. It could be some of dark matter, but there's bounds on, like, because it interacts like a sticky sort of gas that the standard model does. They have self-interaction comes out to being too high. So it mostly can be about 10% of the total dark matter density, which will go down to about 1% with future surveys. So that's the cosmology. There's lots of interesting cosmology with these models, but also we can think about maybe stars form from this mirror matter. And if the physics is similar enough to the standard model physics, which if the couplings are all the same, yes, sorry.
Finish your sentence.
Sorry. Which if the couplings are similar, then these, the, you know, then there's no reason why nuclear physics wouldn't be roughly the same. Then maybe objects like stars could form. Yeah.
I was just wondering, what about mirror massive neutrinos being dark matter or something like that? They don't have a lot of self-interaction.
Right. I mean, we have mirror neutrinos as well, and then, but I mean, these are still pretty light because
maybe you can adjust their mass in the mirror.
Right, but we want to do the minimal amount of Z2 symmetry breaking that we can, which is like the minimal thing to do, which means that the neutrinos are only like a factor of.
So you don't want to get dark matter. That's not the.
No, we're not trying to explain dark matter. That's right. Yeah.
Isn't it the case you need a lot of fine tuning to avoid the mirror neutron being able to decay into a mirror proton? Even when bound in a nucleus. People who make anthropic arguments in the normal sector argue that the
deuteron is like unstable or something. Yeah, actually, it turns out that from. Right, if you do like a. Interestingly, like lattice, there have been lots of lattice studies of if you change the value of the Higgs valve, what the binding energy of the deuteron is. And actually, it turns out that the what appears to be fine tuning actually seems to persist at higher values of the Higgs valve. So actually, it's not. Which is actually kind of an interesting result. Yeah. But I mean, we don't have any problems with stability of the deuteron or anything like that in the mirror sector. It seems like the nuclear physics can be not that different from the standard model physics. Mirror stars have been discussed a bit before by Robert Foote especially. He normally considers an exact mirror sector where the masses are actually the same as in the standard model. And there's never really been a concrete estimate of what the signal of these things, if they existed, would look like. So, okay, we're interested initially in this one specific model, the mirror twin Higgs model, but of course, any model which has some kind of mirror sector, which has nuclear physics, some analog of nuclear physics, which is similar enough to the nuclear physics of the standard model, could in principle form these kind of objects. So we're interested in a much broader class of models than just this one model. And so, okay, yeah, maybe there are mirror stars. We obviously haven't discovered them yet. And I've said before that these two sectors have to interact pretty weakly, otherwise we'd already know about them from collider results. So we might think, how can we ever hope to see these things? But I think it's worth remembering how easy standard model stars were to discover. We've discovered quite a lot of them by now. using pretty primitive instruments originally. So maybe the search for mirror stars is not so hopeless. So how can we hope to see them? Well, in any models where you have a second muon gauge boson, this is the mirror photon, you expect some kind of kinetic mixing between them. They mix. And there's this mixing parameter epsilon, which the current bounds on epsilon for now, this kind of model is around epsilon of 10 to the minus 9. Now, this bound depends on the mass of the lightest particle charged under this U1, which in our case is the mirror electron, which puts us around here. So the current bounds come from this supernova in 1987. So this might seem like a very small value, but actually in the mirror twin Higgs model, in this specific model, epsilon is actually forbidden at one and two loops. So a small value is kind of natural, but there you go. So yeah, in any model where you have massless mirror photons, we're going to assume our mirror photon is massless. You kind of have this slightly confusing basis. There's no preferred physical like mass eigenstate for the photons. So you can sort of, there's two convenient bases you can use. One in which the standard model matter you can think of as being milli-charged under the mirror photon. And there's another basis in which the mirror matter is milli-charged under our photon. So if you think about how could we see these things, here's our star, here's our mirror star. You can think of our telescopes as being essentially milli-charged under the mirror photon. So they will detect an epsilon squared times the intensity of this thing. Now, okay, if epsilon has to be less than 10 to the minus 9, epsilon squared is a very, very, very small, you know, intensity. If you're going to sort of multiply the luminosity of a star by 10 to the minus 18, it's tiny. So you might think, okay, that's it, you can't see them. But if these things capture some standard model matter, which in general they will, because standard model matter will interact, albeit weakly, but it will still interact with the mirror star, then over time, over the lifetime of the star, it will accumulate standard model matter in its core.
Gravitation.
They would interact, right?
Yeah, but there is a small interaction via the mirror photon. So if you know, basically have a nucleus passing a nucleus, one is got a millicharge, they still scatter off each other. It's a suppressed scattering, but it's enough, can be enough to capture particles. And then they get caught in the gravitational well. And if there's, for instance, three standard model electrons flying around, they can induce this conversion process. This is like Thomson scattering, but you start off with a mirror photon, which gets converted to a standard model photon. And if this conversion thing happens, like, for instance, right in the middle of the star, then a mirror photon can just basically, a mirror photon turns into a standard model photon, which then just escapes the star. And if we can detect that standard model photon, then we're, in a sense, peering straight into the core of this object. So you could potentially see highly energetic photons coming from the center of the star. So in order to understand what the rate of this conversion would be, what the overall luminosity into standard model light would be, obviously we need to understand exactly how much matter is captured and then what the properties are inside the star once it's captured, like its density and temperature profiles, and how much of it is ionized. Okay, so I've talked a bit about this mirror twin Higgs model, and in principle it would be a very interesting project to try and understand what a star would look like if you take the masses like 3 to 5 times higher. And this is something in principle you could do, but because I've already said we're interested in a broader class of models than this one model, just to understand the signal a bit better, we're just going to assume that the mirror star is a standard model-like, which means that we can just take some stellar profiles from the standard model of the Sun and higher mass stars, take a few benchmark stars, and just go and calculate how much of this stuff would get captured and what the signal would look like once it's captured. So these are the ingredients of the calculation that we do. Incoming standard model matter from the interstellar medium can scatter off the mirror nuclei in the star. It can also scatter off stuff which has already been captured. Something called evaporation can happen, which is when the thermal velocities of the stuff which is captured is close to the escape velocity of the star, which means that you have some tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution which is going faster than the escape velocity and will just escape. So there's some way that the captured stuff can be ejected. And then we want to know what essentially the equilibrium temperature of this stuff in the star is. So it can get heated up by collisions with mirror nuclei in the star. But this heating is sort of epsilon squared suppressed because it's an interaction between a mirror particle and a standard model particle. So that the heating is suppressed, but there's unsuppressed cooling processes like Bremsstrahlung, collisional excitation, ionization, which can cause the stuff to lose energy. So we don't expect it to be in thermal equilibrium with the star because cooling is unsuppressed, whereas heating is suppressed. And I'll run through some of this stuff quickly because I don't have too much time. But I think I've already said this. The total cross-section for capture can't actually exceed the so-called geometric cross-section. So because the more stuff accumulates in the core, the faster the capture rate is going to be because there's more stuff for it to scatter off. And so this cross-section for capture just grows and grows and grows until it reaches this sort of geometric cross-section, which is just the statement that the total cross-section for capture can't be larger than the sort of geometric area that the star presents as a target. Basically, this is saying that everything that comes at it, it captures. And actually,
why is focusing not important?
That goes into the calculation. It's not just a sort of simple density times velocity times cross section. There is like a sort of focusing effect, but there is still a sense in which you can write down like a maximum total cross section for the capture, total rate anyway, in terms of this geometric area. And it turns out you reach this sort of geometric limit quite quickly for the cross sections that we put in. We basically just chose a value of epsilon 10 to the minus 9 and sort of calculated the total capture rate, the total amount captured over the star's lifetime. And you accumulate quite a lot. We looked into evaporation as well. Evaporation is very interesting because the probability to be at a certain speed depends on the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, which has an exponential in it. It turns out that the probability of evaporation depends exponentially on the mass of the thing which is captured. And actually, there's some critical mass below which evaporation is quite efficient and above which you can neglect it. And this critical mass for the Sun is around 3.5 GeV, which means that hydrogen, which accumulates in the star, actually evaporates from the star very efficiently because it's quite light and the thermal velocities are enough to eject it. But for helium, you can actually neglect it. So what we think is that most of the captured material is actually helium from the interstellar medium rather than hydrogen, which is kind of interesting. And then you can sort of calculate the density profile of this captured matter, assuming it's in hydrostatic equilibrium. It's got some external gravitational field given by the gravitational well of the mirror star. And here we just assume that it's sort of an isothermal temperature profile and go and you can essentially, what happens is it's going to collapse into a ball whose radius is, you can sort of estimate from the virial theorem in terms of its temperature and the density of the mirror nuclei. Of course, we don't know what T is yet because we haven't solved for the equilibrium temperature, which is what we then go and do. So, okay, yes, I said it can be heated up by collisions with the mirror nuclei. You can estimate the heating rate. As I said, there's various ways that it can cool. There's Bremsstrahlung, collisional ionization, collisional excitation. What we do is we take all the rates for all of these processes and equate that to the heating rate to find what sort of equilibrium temperature it's at. Now, I said that the cooling is unsuppressed, whereas the heating is suppressed. So you might think it would just become very, very, very cold, but actually the cooling will drop to zero when the ionized fraction of the gas drops to zero, because all the cooling processes depend in some way on like free electrons coming and hitting things. So actually, for helium, once you go below, you know, 6,000 to 7,000 Kelvin or whatever, basically none of it is ionized and the cooling rate drops to zero. And we find that the equilibrium temperature is around 6,000 Kelvin. And this isn't actually, you know, for all the benchmark stars we put in, we don't get a very different number. This doesn't depend strongly on the mass of the star. So that's essentially, that's all the pieces that we need to do our signal calculation. One thing I didn't mention, which I should have done, is that all these cooling processes also contribute to a signal that we can see. Because it's cooling, it's emitting photons. And that's a signal that we can also see, as well as this conversion signal that I told you about earlier. So we have this, we have this conversion signal due to this sort of Thomson scattering-like process, and we can calculate the intensity as an integral over the entire star of this process happening. And also we can estimate the cooling signal just by a sort of, you know, this is going to be equal to the rate at which energy is pumped into the captured matter. So we have this potential dual signal in X-ray and in the visible spectrum. Visible spectrum because the gas cools down to around a temperature of 6,000 Kelvin or so, which is sort of in the visible. Spectrum kind of looks like that. This is for a star which is 5 times the mass of the sun, again for epsilon 10 to the minus 9. Okay, this is not very clear what I'm plotting here, but this is sort of in the visible range and this is up in X-ray, so you have this big sort of, it sort of looks like two black bodies almost overlaid on top of each other.
What's the amount of mirror matter?
So this is basically, I've just assumed that it's a star-like, it's a mirror star which is like a standard model-like star which is 5 times the mass of the sun. So I've assumed the mass, how much real matter ends up being, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I could tell you. But I think it's sort of
10% or 10 to the minus 10?
Oh, it's definitely of order epsilon squared times the.
Okay.
So if the number of total number of nuclei is like 10 to the, oh, I don't know. It's a small amount compared to the total star. We can even go and calculate the total luminosity from these two types of signal into standard model light that we could actually see. You find that this sort of cooling signal is always much more intense than the X-ray signal. So this is as a function of the mass of the star. This is as a function of epsilon. So this kind of makes sense. You dial down epsilon, you dial down the signal. Could we see them? It's an interesting question. The X-ray flux is pretty dim. I've taken a benchmark star with the mass of the sun at a distance of 1 light year. The X-ray flux is this number, which is pretty dim. That's sort of comparable to the dimmest X-ray sources that we currently know about. But it's pretty sensitive to the mass. If you take a 15 solar mass mirror star, the X-ray flux goes up by a factor of 1,000. The question of could you see these, I think if you were looking directly at them with an X-ray telescope, then you could. But of course, doing like a whole sky survey, you'd never pick up one of these things. More promising is the visible light signature, which, as I said, is much more an intense signal. At 10 light years, this benchmark star that I talked about would have the same magnitude as one of the moons of Jupiter, which was discovered in the year 2000. At 100 light years, the same star has an apparent magnitude as another moon, a moon of Saturn, which was discovered in 2004, magnitude of about 25. For comparison, Gaia aims to catalog all stars brighter than magnitude 20. So this is sort of, it's I'm not sure exactly what kind of bounds we could put on these things, but it seems like there would be some bounds from Gaia on what how far away these things could be. I mean, if there are any within a certain distance, we would know about them already. And of course, what you're actually seeing is a very dim visible light signal. So it's dimmer than you expect a real star to be. You could point an X-ray telescope at it and potentially see this X-ray signal, and the intensity of the X-rays compared to the intensity of light would be a smoking gun signature that this is something very exotic. You know, these things would also have parallax because they are nearby things. You could tell they were nearby, but of course they're much dimmer than you expect a star to be. So I will conclude there. I hope I argued that these things are at least theoretically well motivated. If they capture interstellar matter, there's this conversion process into detectable light, a potentially detectable X-ray signal. The heating and cooling of the captured matter also produces a signal in a different frequency band. And it's a weird signal. It's a faint, nearby hot object. It's hot. We know it's hot because we can see the X-rays coming out of it. And it's nearby, so it would have a parallax. And so, yeah, maybe these things could be detected in the near future. But there you go. Thanks.
Sorry, so I may have missed this, but do you expect there to be any correlation between, like, positionally where you find normal stars and mirror stars? Because if the answer is yes, then couldn't you just point X-ray telescopes at globular clusters or something?
Right, the answer to that is it's actually very difficult to know, because essentially what you'd have to do is sort of n-body simulations of the galactic sort of the mirror matter distribution and the standard model matter distribution and see how much they correlate. Those kind of simulations are pretty difficult to do, especially at the resolution of individual stars. This is a parallel project that David is working on, actually, to just try and see how much information we actually can get from those kind of simulations. But it's not clear what kind of correlation you expect or even what the size of the galactic mirror disk would be compared to the standard model one. There's lots of elements that go into that simulation. Yes.
Benson go after this, like.
Yeah, there are. I think there are some constraints you can put on from like micro lensing and things like that. I think when we looked at this, the constraints are not enough to rule these out at all. Like there are some constraints on how many of them there are, but pretty weak constraints, I think. Yeah. Yes.
What is the rough fraction of mirror matter to baryonic matter in the Milky Way? On that?
That's essentially a free parameter, I think.
How big could it be?
It could be at most 10% of the dark matter. It couldn't be more than 10% of the dark matter, because then we'd know about it from like large-scale structure bounds and self-interaction, but I think that's the current maximum it could be, yeah.
But like normal matter would be much more condensed than the dark matter, because it's self-interaction, so
right.
It's cool to the center of the halo.
Right, and that's where some of these bounds come from, I think, yeah. Yes.
You assume that the mirror sector and the standard model sector are exactly equal apart from the different Higgs. Why is it a free parameter that you have the mirror matter density not?
I think it depends on baryogenesis and things like that. Like you can assume that baryogenesis in the mirror sector. Yeah. Right.
So would you have differences then, or
that's
minimal assumptions that would be?
I mean, a lot of these models aren't really UV complete up to the point where you can start talking about things like baryogenesis. We don't know whether the baryogenesis would be the same in one sector and another sector. They might be, in which case you can make some predictions, but that's why that's essentially a free parameter, yeah.
Another question, so maybe you said it and I missed it. So you said you have a fraction of epsilon squared of real matter in these mirror stars. So why isn't it order one if you just have gravitational pumping, like your potential wells by... Like usual dark matter.
Yeah, I'm starting to think that epsilon squared times the density of the mirror star I said was actually incorrect. I could definitely get the numbers for you. I can't remember. Once you start having it scattering off itself, the stuff which is already captured, then the capture rate grows exponentially because it's proportional to the amount which is captured. And then, as I say, you reach this geometric limit. I mean, this is actually quite a familiar idea from people who think about dark matter capture in the sun. And we basically get the same number of similar results that they get, because at the end of the day, you have some cross-section, but it becomes independent of the cross-section once you reach this geometric limit. So you basically have this geometric limit times the age of the sun gives you how much gets captured. So this, So that's where that number comes from, but I can't remember what the fraction of the total.
It's not order one.
It's not order one, no. Maybe it's like 10 to the minus 10 or something like that. Yes.
So just to double check, following on Lena's question, so if it was mirror symmetric up to the UV, you would predict that you would have the same amount of mirror matter and ordinary matter. Is that strictly? I know that's more than the 10% you quoted. It's more like 20%. Is that strictly ruled out, or is that on the threshold?
Yeah, I'm not actually sure what the answer to that is, whether you would expect the same amount. I'm not an expert on the cosmological side of this, but like I could get back to you on that. Yeah, I'm not sure whether there's more that goes into that calculation than just the amounts that you get from baryogenesis. I'm not sure.
Any more questions?
Baryogenesis minimum is a
Okay, well, thanks again.